unless you are willing and recognize the need to change your life completely, you can't be who you are. And then walking down the hill, I says, wait a minute, but one of the things that I said when I was in the, one of the things that really, one of the fires that was burning in me when I was in the mental hospital was the desire to, when there's shock and all sorts of things are around. And my response was, you know, don't change me. You know, don't change one bit of me. You know, and I was, at the time, I was, you know, really, you know, messed up. But I did have this one thing, don't change me, just fix me. Fix what's there. And don't take anything away and don't add anything. But don't change me. Just fix me and I'll go. This is what I have to be. I have to be who I am in the world. And then I said, well, gee, you know, that sounds like those things are completely opposite statements. And, well, it sounds like, but it's not. It may be a paradox. It may be what Carol would call a two-statement theology. And unless you're willing and recognize the need to change your life completely, you can't be who you are, and who you are is who you're supposed to be. And also, the statement that don't change a bit of me, but just fix me. Get me out again. Each of those statements is addressed to a different party, a different audience. And who would it be addressed to? You know, say, take these statements. The one about unless you're willing to, you know, unless I'm willing to change my life completely, I can't be who I am. Who's that addressed to? Who's that talking to? Say it again.
The person that's in us that thinks we're right, or that we don't need to change, that we've lost the way of
We're saying, yeah, I guess it's awfully hard. I asked a bad question.
You can't be,
I didn't give you. Well, you could call yourself. And I don't know if, is this the kind of statement you want to come down and say, a Christian does do this? That's a scary one. And this book will have a lot of the footnotes that I'll put in the thing, and then I'll say, question mark, you know, after. Is this the kind of statement that you say, a Christian does this, you know, or a Christian should have this understanding? And there are questions, and I would really question this one, but does it have any relevance to the book, that statement? Unless you're willing to change your life completely, you can't be who you are. Does that have any connection? Do you make any connection with the book? Put it that
elder,
way first.
The elder told Alyosha to leave the monastery, which was something completely new for him, wasn't it?
It's something he didn't want to do at all.
And isn't that comparable to changing his life completely, from going from a nap to life to
Mount Meru? That's changing a something you do. I mean, sometimes it helps to think we have things, we do things, we are. Having, doing, being. To think in terms of those three things. And now the thing about going out into the world is doing something. And it will mean he'll have more of something and less of something. But is his... When Zazima asks him to do this, or tells him to, as an elder, and remember, Alyosha has to do what the elder says within that church. That's why just before that passage, you know, they talk about some things that happened to people who didn't do, you know, what their elders said. But was that a statement about change your being? I don't think so. That was on a doing and having. You'd understand that that way. Any quick connection? Just
could that this guy could that possibly fit in with Dimitri at all? because it seemed to me that he was always not trying to change, well, sometimes trying to change, you know, like with the money, also with the half of the money around his neck. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he would keep half of it, and then he wouldn't be a thief, you know, because mm-hmm. he had half the money and everything. It was always like halfway, mm-hmm. you know, and even after Grushenka left, and then he
That's
went,
really good connection, by the way, halfway.
Well, it, no, it's it a re- seems that he always went, he only ever got halfway, and then he'd go back, but he never really went out, well, he said changed completely, but he never changed completely. And that was just like when he went to Grushenka, when she finally went back with Drolba, mm-hmm. and he was going to go there and just see if she was happy, and then mm-hmm. go out and shoot himself. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he never made it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Half is a great word to go along with Dmitri. Just great. Great connection. Half what?
Isn't Ivan happy?
Oh, I think we're going to find fractional people. But right now, at this moment, that half, right, for Dmitri, I don't know. I mean, they are, no one, remember, is non-ambivalent or not mysterious. No one is a stereotypical character. And I think when people misunderstand Karamazov, they make... Well, Ivan's the intellectual, and then there's Dmitri the sensualist, and then there's Alyosha the spiritual man, and then there's Fyodor the just the, you know, and then there's Smerdnikov the, yeah, you've got these things, they help, but they're very dangerous categories, just as every category is. What we attempted to do then is to make cartoons out of them, and just as we make cartoons out of people, right? Oh, you're this... And then we, in a sense, do surgery, major surgery on a person and cut everything that doesn't fit our statement about him away, you know, so that we can be comfortable in saying Ivan's intellectual. Ivan, remember, loves those sticky green leaves. Right? And I don't think, such an odd statement, the sticky green leaves, you know, but you don't ever forget it, really. And Dmitri and Alyosha, talking about I'm on the bottom rung of the ladder and so forth. And especially with the book, Dostoevsky wanted to write five volumes for this story. And then he said, I can't, because he was really old. This is the last book he wrote. And he says, I'll write two books. And it'll be called the Life of the Greatest Sinner, I believe is the The Life of a Great Sinner, and Alyosha is the main character. And this is the first book. He never wrote the second one. So Alyosha is his hero, the great sinner. Huh? You know? Wait a minute. And oh, I would like to read that second book. But what connection do you make on the first statement? Unless you know that you have to change your life completely, you cannot be who you are. And in a sense, now there's a problem there. If a crap detector goes off in your head, it's good, because the be who you are. You know. Well, you are who you are. You know, and then unless you won't change your life and become something that you aren't now. Okay? And that's where a crap detector should go off. Is that what you were going
to
say?
No, I was going to say there's a difference between unless you are willing to change your life, unless you realize you have to change your life.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference in those
mm-hmm.
two.
Mm-hmm. There's a really interesting thing there, is that it doesn't mean to know that you have to change your life and be willing to change your life completely. It doesn't mean that I become you, or you become me, you know, or I become somebody else. Yeah. Or did I change that much in... that anyone would notice that I changed that much. But there is a real recognition that maybe we have to make before we can start being who we are. And that's one of them. And the connection is the verily, verily I say unto you, unless a grain of wheat fall into the ground and die, it cannot, you know, live again. That is the connection on that. And then it's addressed. The question was a bad one, Tom, that you tried. I didn't ask the question right. Who is this talking to? Yes, you could talk to some people about it and everything, but it's addressed more to God. It's sort of like a prayer. And the other one is addressed to whom? Don't change me. Don't change one. I would scream this, you know. Don't change me. Don't change a bit of me. Fix me and get me out of here. I have to be who I am. I have to see the world with the eyes that I've been given. I have to be this person. I don't want you to do some things I know you can do. You can give me a new personality. You can shock my past right out of my brain, or underneath the surface of my brain, as they did to the guy in Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Persig. And that sometimes I've wondered if they did that to me. I don't know. But don't change it. And it was violent feeling. And it wasn't something, I wasn't just talking about myself. That was, to me at the time, that was not something I was saying just because I'd rather not, you know, I'd rather you not change me, because here I am needing to be changed, knowing it. But you don't change me. Man, do not change me. It's addressed to man. It's addressed to man. In spite of how ridiculous it seemed at that moment to say that. And it was... It was another thing that I have to hold to be who I am. I could be treated as a poultry keeper treats his poultry, chapter 3 of The Abolition of Man, you know, and be changed. And I knew that could happen. I didn't want it to happen. But those two things are true. And they relate very much to this, Terry, to Dmitri, to Alyosha, Ivan, Fyodor. Everybody in there, everyone in there. And they respond to that, those two statements, in different ways, don't they? They respond to it differently. Every character is going to respond to it differently. One other thing before we get into the, you know, wherever you want to be, one other difference that I came across. And it's in comparing yourself to other people, and the characters comparing themselves to other people, what do they say? I see each person, that's an important, that's one of those important things that shows our own character. And we'll show the characters of people in the book. What do they think of themselves compared to other people? What is the statement that their life makes? Not always in words. I mean, it isn't a conscious thing. But what statement do their lives make? Now, take Smerdnikov. What statement does his life make about him comparing himself to other people?
Doesn't he think that he belongs to be on a much higher plane of I mean, he's a lowly servant, but he has such a high opinion of himself that he feels he's been done wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So what does he say? I am... What?
Smarter than you, but not...
Smarter than you?
Or as smart as you.
As smart as you. Okay, now that's what I mean in this kind of questioning. Does he say, I'm smarter than you, I'm just as good as you are, I'm better than you are?
I get the impression he said he was better than he did. Mm-hmm. Because, but I can see, I would think that would be an easy, especially since he's in a lower position, it would be easier to say, I'm better than you, than I am just as good as you.
Unless he's, but he's a half-brother, too. And he's working as a valet. And a certain thing. Okay, we're not going to be able to come up with things that, you know, hard, fast, disproved it, page such and such, he says, and so forth. Well, you can on some of them, actually. But on Smerdnikov, let's just for now say that he says, I'm just as good as you are. Now, can you imagine a person living a life, or does this make sense to you? A person's life says, I'm just as good as you are, to the other person. Does that make sense to you? I mean, it's a metaphor right away, but their life, their whole life says, I'm just as good as you are. Does it make sense? hands? How many responds? Does it?
Oh, it doesn't to me, because he sees how base Ivan is. You know, and so if he says it's just as good, and deep down he knows how bad, you know, how calculating Ivan, or, you know, that he wants the murder, you know, he may say that on the outside, but he knows, you know, that there's, that it isn't good.
Mm-hmm. Smirnikov is has a tendency to be outside the Tao, outside the value.
Mm-hmm.
And that will make it very difficult for him to say anything relating to work. You know, I mean, he recognizes, you know, he, how does he respond to it? In a very odd and in many ways cold way. And in many connections, Steve brought up that Ivan was like the father. Somebody said Ivan was like the father. And other places we have Smirnikov is like Ivan. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the similarities is the ability to see things outside of any value. But and Smirnikov does feel that he's better than some people. But addressing himself to his brothers, he feels like he's, you know, I'm just as good as you are. You know, I'm up there with you guys. And from a starting point of head feeling like people think he's left, you know, he's making a counter statement. And good. What does it mean to Smirnikov? But I'm just as good as you guys. And can you see in your own lives times when you have said you've lived to, I'm just as good as you? I have, I think that's related very closely to I'm gonna show the bastards. I mean, at certain times in my life, I've felt like I'm gonna show the bastards. I'll show them. You know, they think I can't do it, and I'll show them. And that's sort of living that way. Well, how about Dmitri? What does Dmitri say? His is very clear. I am what?
Rotten.
I am 1,000 times, I think of the quote, I am 1,000 times more vile. And say to the brothers, to you guys, let's keep it just to the brothers here. And there are times when you felt that way too, right? I mean, I must be a real reptile to be thinking this at this time. I mean, what a wild reptilian response to this situation, or something like that. Dmitri's doing that again and again and again. How about Alyosha? He says to his brothers, I am...
worse?
No, he doesn't say that.
Just the same as?
The same as. I am the same as. And the same is used as a negative. It's a negative thing,
mm-hmm.
right there. But I am the same as you. And he says that to everybody. I am the same. We are the same. I'm the same as you. I'm no better and no worse. That's what Alyosha says. Well, how about Ivan? I think he makes two statements. The one about standing outside the value thing, and he would say, standing outside of value and saying better or good or anything like that, then he'd say, what?
Better.
Doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference. I mean, there's no way to really, you know, so what? That those kinds of questions just don't, you know, have anything to say about it. And then other things he says are what? Yeah.
Does he think himself on a high because it doesn't affect him? Or is it just total indifference?
I think in effect it can be indifference, but it has an effect of pride. I think if you can end up in pride. And pride should be completely counter to any, if you don't accept value, quality, difference in quality, so, then you shouldn't, pride should not be possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a good point. Now make a connection there. And that's a good argument on relativism, isn't it? Well, if there isn't any value and so forth, why pride? And there is pride. There is always pride. And I think it will be pride until after the second coming. And remember in the Old Testament, pride and arrogance is what? The enemy of God. And he says it in Jeremiah. My enemy is arrogant. Pride. And I think we can take that to mean that it's going to be around for a long time. You do, when you say it doesn't make any difference, you kind of put yourself in the position of a god, and then through that you get some pride. But what other thing does he say? We talked yesterday about the eyebrow rope, proud eyelid. Superciliousness. And it's, I'm better. You know, the feeling that I'm better. And disdainful. Yeah. And then Fyodor? And he says it in a neat way, in one sentence. He says, you know, and when he's explaining why he's a buffoon, you know, he says, I'm worse than everybody, and I walk in. And just in the course of the sentence, he turns it right upside down. He says, I'm worse than everybody, and you know, really vile, you know, father of lies. No, I'm not the father of lies. You know, I'm worse than everybody, and I will show them that I'm better, you know, better than any of them. Or they're worse than I am. Not so much that I'm better, but they're worse than I am. And well, now on asking the same kind of question, each of these guys does come down in a different place, don't they? Now that isn't something that we can say, aha, the key to the Brothers Karamazov or something like that. And it's not the final word at all. It's a word to start with. But to see, how do they respond to this question? How do you relate to, or how would they respond to this question? How you compare yourself to your brothers, and then you can answer for each of them from what you know, and then you can start to see more clearly some differences.
And what about when Ivan is on the train to Moscow, and right before it pulls in, he says, "I'm a vile, despicable."
I'm a scoundrel.
Yeah.
Now, did he ever get out really of the valuable? Did he? He wanted to, but did he make it? I mean, did he really manage to say that it wasn't, that there was no such thing as value? Did he live it?
No.
I mean, he could say it, but did he live
it? No. No. He was tortured by it.
Yeah, continually. It just went on through the whole thing. And to where even he could say, of course I won't hurt my father. You know, I won't hurt him. But I hold the right to wish... all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And he did draw a line. And in one way, see, then that connects with, I mean, that business of I hold the right to wish anything. And that goes to the Sermon on the Mount, where you have Christ saying that, you know, you even think it and you've done it. And that's one of the big themes in here, too. Now, we talked about the theme of contempt, you know. Ivan has a certain kind of contempt. Ham had a certain kind of contempt. Alyosha is asked the question, is this contempt when we analyze, when we look into the heart of people? And then he says no, because we know we are the same. And it would be, with the implication that it is contemptible. You are showing contempt if you look in any other way. And the contempt theme goes along with what we've been doing right now. That's why I mention it. You know, how do you see the guy across from you? And I think we do a little of all of this in our lives. And we have. If you ask that question then about yourself, so certain situations in your life should start coming up, and maybe you've forgotten them for years, but you ask the question and you're going to start, well, did I ever say this? And then, whoa. And did I ever say this? And whoa. There's another one. And so forth. And it starts to fill up. And you start to be able to read this book as a book about yourself. As a book about yourself. Well, that's those two things I wanted to say to start this. well, not to start it, in a sense, I don't want it to continue in this line necessarily. But I didn't want to say that today. Get that in. Okay, Ken, is there a way we could keep ourselves to the first the first part? That's three books, the first three books in part one. Now there's some tremendous chapters in there. That's one, the Grand Inquisitor chapter is one of the most famous things done in literature. Many people know it, but don't know that it's in the Brothers Karamazov. And it's kind of unfortunate because the book is filled with tremendous chapters. But what do you want to talk about the first book? Any particular part that seems to be very central in hitting you and hitting your center, or central to what Dostoevsky's doing, or something that is particularly some scene that particularly clarifies someone's what someone in the book is like?
On 127, I was particularly struck with
which chapter?
It's the ending of chapter 3, and right before the Confessions of an Ardent Heart and Prose.
Chapter 3.
Let's see.
Confessions of an Ardent Heart and Prose.
Yeah, right.
Just before that?
Yeah.
Confessions of what?
Confessions of an... Let's see. Yeah, that's Confessions of an Ardent Heart in verse.
Elisaveta, Veta is the name of that chapter.
Mm-hmm. And Mitya is talking, and what the head brands as shameful may appear as sheer beauty to the heart, but can there be beauty in Sodom? Yes, and believe me, it is precisely there that beauty lies for most men. Weren't you aware of that secret? That terrible thing is that beauty is not only frightening but a mystery as well. That's where God and the devil join battle, and their battlefield is the heart of man. But actually everyone always talks about his own particular trouble. I'm getting to the point. Listen to me. And
where do you have that? It's not in the Elisaveta. It's in the Confession of the Passion and Heart chapter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But now it's
in the verse.
Huh?
It's the last paragraph before the Confession of Ardent Heart and Prose.
Oh, okay.
It's the Ardent Heart and Verse.
Okay. And it's the last one. Okay, my translation is different than that.
Yeah, I noticed that when you read before.
What's your last, what's right after the battlefield is the heart of man? What did you say?
But actually, everyone always talks about his own particular trouble. No, I'm getting to the point. Listen to me.
Okay, and this one, it's now a man always talks of his own ache. Listen, now to come to facts.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this translation says. Mm-hmm. But the rest is the same up to that point. What do you want to say there?
Well, I wondered about the beauty is evil. And I sensed that when I read it was evil. But then I thought, when I read on that, where God and the devil join battle, certainly that is a noble thing. Perhaps not, though. Perhaps depending on the outcome, you know, whether it's noble or not.
I don't have the word noble.
Well, no, that wasn't, that's what I was thinking, but I was thinking of how you love to do something wrong at times. You know, you say you hate it, but you really like it. You really enjoy it.
Okay, how many people can feel that way, what Karin says? About enjoying doing something that you know is wrong. There's a kind of a... Is that general pretty well?
Yeah, I think there's questions. Yeah.
Okay, how many people can feel that way, what Karin says? About enjoying doing something that you know is wrong. There's a kind of a... Is that general pretty well?
Yeah, I I think that's pleasure and sin.
But what kind, you know, I was thinking, what kind
of... What kind of enjoyment?
Yeah. And that being beauty, you know, kind of a deliciousness.
Deliciousness is a good word to use to describe that kind of feeling.
And is that what, then he says, the terrible thing is that beauty is not only frightening, but a mystery as well. Then I was thinking of the most beautiful things I've ever seen, like, you know, just maybe a rose, you know, or, you know, the good beauties, are they tantalizing because they have perfection or because they have this other kind of sin? Is it sinful for perfection? And I thought, you know, you see something so excruciatingly perfect, you know. Mm-hmm. I was kind of thinking through those kinds of thoughts, and if, you know, I don't know where the question came, but the confusion came with that, you know. Is that the curse? Is that curse? In there.
So, let's... What about Keats? What would Keats say to this passage? No? How do you mean? Ode to the Grecian Urn? At the end it says, truth is beauty, and beauty truth, that is all you know, and all you need to know. You know, what?
Yeah.
How does this work with what Keats is saying there? Now the God and the devil are fighting there, and the battlefield is the heart of man. And so in a sense, the beauty is like the battlefield. When God and the devil are fighting, for what? I mean, why are they fighting? They're not fighting for beauty.
They're fighting for the heart,
what?
The real beauty, or the
truth. I don't know. The Keats thing, Keats, at the time he wrote that, wouldn't know what to do with this. At the time he wrote that. Later on, he would. You know, after he writes. Yeah. Okay, but that line, truth and beauty and so forth. I mean, there is a real coldness about Keats at that point to me. Truth is beauty. Beauty, truth. Well, truth must be pretty small, if my response is, you know, like that. I mean, and beauty must be pretty small, too. If there's something beautiful, I think, as Karn is saying, your response to something beautiful sometimes can just be overwhelming. You know? It's not a calm, earnest sort of thing. It's just, you know, can obsess you. Well, what are they fighting for? The battlefield is the heart of man. In a sense, beauty is there in the heart, is the heart of man, in a sense.
I was wondering about this one line is, what to the mind is shameful, what to the mind is shameful is beauty, and nothing else to the heart. And somehow it takes beauty, that takes beauty and doesn't make it the central part of the struggle, takes it out of the heart and doesn't make that what the struggle is over, for some reason.
I don't think they're talking about the concept of beauty as really going to it here. Maybe I'm wrong. But we're just saying, I think one of the key senses, but can there be beauty in sorrow? Yes, believe me, that is precisely there that beauty lies for most men. I think he's talking about the general thing, beauty in things which are not perhaps beautiful. Beauty in sin, drunkenness, fornication. If the connection to Sodom is a biblical one.
You're right, you have to watch out how to use that. I mean, what is he meaning about beauty? And the heart is passionate, and this guy is just considered the sensualist. And is it passion? Beauty is what man responds passionately to. Is that what it is?
Possibly. Maybe it can be a concept of what man holds as beautiful. May not necessarily be a work of art or a flower or an office or anything like that, but maybe in fact, I don't know, maybe I'm going off the wrong track, but when I read this, it struck me that the idea and concept of the deliciousness of sin and the kind of beauty that is like just the deliciousness of sin, the sweet taste, as someone else calls it in the book, and that's the means for the battlefield between God and the devil, the man's heart. The way I took it is God's gift can be used either for blessing or curse. And that the beauty of God's gift can be used by God as a blessing or the devil as a curse. That struggle taking place in the man's heart. That's kind of my words didn't exactly say it right, but mm-hmm. That's kind of the idea mm-hmm. that struck me at reading.
Okay. Does are we then to get rid of the passion that enables us to see something beautiful because it can lead us to Sodom? Because passion can lead us to Sodom. What God and the devil are fighting in the heart of man and heart responds to beauty, reveal passion. And, well, there are two sides. So what's one fighting for and what are they fighting for? Now just to win me? Or will I just kind of go along with the, you know, if it's a war, so if it's me, you know, I'm done. So I'm kind of a death on either side, see. No matter what happens, there's a kind of death. But is it a death of passion? That is being desired by, say, the devil or by God. They desire that we suppress the passion. Suppress the seeing of the beautiful. Now Dimitri says that the mind knows it's shameful, the heart sees as beautiful. But that's just one thing he says. He doesn't say the whole thing. That's one thing that he says. Maybe that's half of what should be said by Dimitri. But what do they want? What do God and the devil want? Now, the big theme, if you had to put it in a word, of everything Dostoevsky wrote, is the theme that the heart of man is the battlefield. Man is the battlefield between God and the devil. And never having read, and this is what's one of the things that this book really hit me hard, is because I'd never read Karamazov by the time I cracked up, and that was what it felt like. People asked me what it felt like, and I'm a battlefield. And there's a battle going on, and I don't know who's on the, I don't know the side, I don't know the reason, I don't know, but there's a battle going on, and makes a lot of sense to me. But what do they want? Now go back to, well, we don't go back anywhere. Go up to the top of that page in that poem, the last four lines of the poem. And bounteous nature's kindly breast, all things that breathe drink joy. And birds and beasts and creeping things all follow where she leads. Her gifts to man are friends in need, the wreath, the foaming musk, to angels, vision of God's throne, the insects, sensual life.
Oh, that insect part.
Insects.
I'm an insect.
You're going to get... Yeah?
Yeah.
John, you're still out there for a moment.
What is yours? What do your last two lines say?
Sensual lust, angels, happiness, divine.
Okay, they just turn the turn the last two lines around.
Well, the rest of it's too.
Yeah. Well, the most important thing there, I think, though, is are the last two lines.
What he did in ours is he rhymed all the poems, and I imagine, I remember thinking he must have really had to twist the translation to make it all rhyme in English, if they rhymed in Russian.
They rhymed in this one, and you do a pretty good job on it, and you can get pretty close, usually. I think this, in this one, the wreath, the foaming must. Must is an odd word to use there, and it had, I think he put must there to rhyme with lust. You can't mess up lust in the translation, the word lust, but you can really mess up
dust
must.
Huh?
Use
dust.
Dust, okay.
Do
see
you have
that?
Four.
The foaming must to angels, vision of God's throne, to insects, sensual lust.
Aren't you foaming dust?
To man prostrated.
And dust. Joy brings friends and cheering wine.
Boy.
But you know, yeah. Must and wine. There's a must in wine. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. No, but no. When you make wine, there's a must.
We'll see who has that. The textual criticism, even in this, the text says. Is really different. The last two lines are the same, but no, they aren't either. It gives the insects.
They're talking about Mother Nature.
He has the real split in here. He talks in terms of joy. Here they don't get that specific. I don't think. Yes, it is because joy in the preceding stanza. But the thing is that there's a different response to the same thing.
And that's what the fight is over. Which direction the response goes.
Where are you going to respond? Mm-hmm. How are you going to respond to something that is beautiful? Now, not with passion or coldly. That isn't what they want. You know, but very passionately. But as angels or insects. You know, respond to the thing, the same thing, in a different way. And that's the... Well, we talked about that yesterday. Remember about Ham and the brothers. They knew the same thing. They saw the same thing. They responded to it differently. And that made all the difference. And here, what response do you make to the whatever it is that Dmitri sees? And Alyosha can see it too. And they can respond very differently, the two things, in very different ways. That response, by the way, connects to the abolition of man a lot, too.
Is the same thing meant here? When I think of God and the devil, I think of God.
When you think of...
You know, when he talks about God and the devil, Zorba talks about the God-devil, devil-God.
Mm-hmm.
Is he talking about the same sorts of things? Or is that, am I going off in the wrong tangent?
It's different when Thousand Socrates says God, he means something else. I mean, it isn't what Dostoevsky's meant. Mm-hmm. Different kind of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different, different conception of devil too that Zorba has.
To pretty major, they're the same.
There are going to be lots of connections between Zorba and Dmitri. Yeah.
Alyosha wouldn't say as the head what the head
for hands as shameful may appear sheer beauty to the heart. He would bring them together then in a response. This is more of a, I don't want to categorize, you know, but a sensualist type of response. Separating the body from the mind.
It's not the thing that's shameful, it's my response.
Okay.
The thing itself is
okay.
Beautiful.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But how I respond to it, what do I do? Then that's what he would be talking about. That the it isn't shameful in itself. You know, this way he said talks about Grishenka, about she has a curve that goes all around her.
Mm-hmm.
Really neat. She has a curve that goes all around her, and it just knocks the nature dead. Alyosha wouldn't appreciate the curve. See it. You'd see the same thing. But he would respond differently. Now that's really important, because a lot of times we think when people respond differently, they just don't see the same thing. And I think more and more you'll find out the same thing is seen, can be seen, and the response different. It isn't that, the guy's head is in such and such a place and he just doesn't, you know, see the reality that I see. That that same reality, that same fact, the same premise can be seen. But the conclusion can be different, as you know from rhetoric. Right? Remember that statement I keep doing. You know, fall of man is from the premise to the conclusion. There's the fact. Now what do I make of it? Now what do I do next? And people continue to go across. And we can see the same fact. We can realize that X is happening and we don't respond the way, you know, one would think we should respond, seeing it. there isn't a fantasy that you have that I don't have. I mean, Dmitri sees nothing that you have not seen, or I have not seen. But I'm not running around like that. You know, but what's seen and then what's responded to. And how we respond to feelings that we have. We have all sorts of passionate feelings. How we respond to our own lust. You know, have it? Okay, now what do I do about it? You know, do I act it out, or do, you know, I get a fantasy and then shall I seek that fantasy out, or shall I try to follow that lust up in order to be honest to my instincts or something? Or honest to the dark gods in my blood? Those little guys, they must be awfully small. How small are they? You know something about it.
They are small.
You know? But... Well, what do we respond to? Okay, sure, it's a fact. Yeah, right. You know, certain times of your life are different. You have different kinds of lusts at different times of your life. But I think lusts are pretty much equal in quantity. Any time, they're just different in kind. But the degree is about the same. But then how do you respond to them? And if you start trying to, if you pay too much attention to them, dwell on them, you can get very, you know, shaken and wrecked and destroyed and Dmitri goes through a lot of this. But...
Does he recognize his... does he recognize the difference in seeing? I guess I'm not seeing where this poem comes from right now. Does he recognize that, you know, there are these two different ways of responding and that it falls into one? Is that what he's saying? Or?
The poem says that. I don't know if at that time he recognizes it that much. But he does say, he does recognize two kinds of responses, because he has the Madonna and Sada. And he says, how can a man let's just read that whole thing again. I am that insect. You know. In other words, when he says that, he says, I'm not that angel. I am that insect, brother, and it is said of me especially. All we Karamazovs are such insects.
An angel as you are, that insect lives in you too and will stir up a tempest in your blood. Tempest, because sensual lust is a tempest, worse than a tempest. Beauty is a terrible, an awful thing. It is terrible because it has not been fathomed and never can be fathomed, for God sets us nothing but riddles. Here the boundaries meet and all contradictions exist side by side. I am not a cultivated man. Brother, I've thought a lot, but I've thought a lot about this. It's terrible what mysteries there are. Too many riddles weigh men down on earth. We must solve them as we can and try to keep a dry skin in the water. Now, a dry skin in the water. A dry skin in the water. What connection? Huh? Nope. Nope. Dry skin in the water. In but not of the world. You know, in but not of the world. It's a beautiful, beautiful statement.
We don't have that.
Oh, what did they do with yours?
Just to climb dry out of the water.
Well, yeah. That's nice too. But but this is in the water. You know.
We're always in the water.
Yeah, we're always in the water. To try to keep a dry skin in the water. Beauty, I can't endure the thought that a man of lofty mind and heart begins with the ideal of Madonna, this response of the angel, the vision of God's throne that one sees when you see the beautiful as the world. And the things in it, the creation. You start out that way and you end up with the ideal of Sodom, the picture of what the world is like, Prince of Darkness ruling it. And it's the same thing. Now you've heard me say that the world and creation occupy the same space. Right? The world and creation. The world that's ruled by the Prince of Darkness and creation, which is ruled by, you know, the Prince of Light, it occupies the same space. And I guess this is referring to that. That's the connection. I better write that down. Use it next year. Okay, what we must solve? So we must solve these riddles as we can and try to keep a dry skin in the water. Beauty, I can't endure the thought of a man of lofty mind and heart begins with the ideal of the Madonna and ends with the ideal of Sodom. What still more awful is that the man with the ideal of Sodom in his soul does not renounce the ideal of Madonna. You know, you just can't get rid of some of that divine response. It'd be so much easier if you could really put out the light. But it's, I think the light burns underwater, you know? It's like those phosphorus things that they, or whatever, those little underwater flares. But,
when you were younger, we always went swimming, not always, but once in a while went swimming at night and you have lights underneath the water.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to drill into it.
Yeah, yeah. Lights
underneath.
There's light. There's light there. And you have a man of the ideal of Sodom. That they both exist side by side in the same man is part of our tension that Dostoevsky talks about. We want to make it either Sodom or Madonna. I mean, we want to make everything just, you know, it's we only see this beatific vision. Or, you know, we're in this realistic world of tooth and claw, you know, and so forth. We respond with lust or we respond with awe. And with humility, and with excitement and joy, but we tend to want just one or the other, and we keep bouncing between the two. I think.
A finiteness.
Yeah. Well, we want it. We want black and white, or white. We don't want black and white. We don't want paradox. I think one of the biggest things that man runs away from is paradox. We want simplicity. You're either a punk or you're my buddy, but. You know, but nothing in between. You know, I either want to think everybody is just fine, or I want to think they're all a bunch of punks. Now that's not true. I can sit there right now. I don't feel that way now at all. But I know I used to, going around find out where people's heads are at. You know, there's one of us. There's one of them. There's one of us. There's one of them. You know, that guy's troubled. That guy's safe. That guy's troubled. That guy's safe. And I think when we're tired or ornery or something like that, we tend to fall back into that kind of thing. When we start getting worried, we start doing all those things again.
What is it that we feel, though, when we don't do those things? When we start getting worried and we start getting ornery and all that, that comes up. But then there must be some element that's there on the opposite side, too.
Well, there is. I say, like, right now, you know, now I'm not feeling that way at all. At this present moment, you know, there's no kind of feeling of that, and actually my days are pretty well spent in that. that there's not. I haven't done that so much as I did, like, say, 10 years ago. You know, a lot more of it. But now it just isn't. It isn't something that I do much.
For me myself, is it just a lack of that, all that other garbage that gets in the way, or is it a filling up of something that squeezes that out?
Well, one thing is that when we know what Alyosha knows, nothing can hurt him. You know? Thank you. Nothing can hurt him. And once he made that assumption, it is an assumption, once he made that assumption, he never thought of it again. And when you make that assumption, it's threat that tends to make us do this kind of thing. It's a fear that makes us kind of, you know, put guys here or there, you know, try to figure things out. My gosh, we're in this chaotic world, filled with riddles. I've got to figure all this out. Well, you're this, and 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 that's that, and so forth. And we end up wrecking all this, all the mystery, you know, the beauty. We want things to be our conception of perfect, which is pretty dull. Our imaginations are terrible.
John,
is
that like evaluating with the judgment, as opposed to, can you just evaluate without passing the judgment and say, well, he's like this, and just make him note it, but not really, can you just note it, but not really act on it, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you can. You can see and not
because I know I do that. That's the first thing. Well, like, evaluate, like there's a lot of new people in the village, and so I, you know, immediately when there's new people, you wanna kind of figure out what's going on, and so like I start evaluating people and you know, talking with them, my opinions form and stuff, and naturally you're gonna put it into a form of, he's like that, I don't see how you can avoid it. So.
But there's. There's a real difference between evaluation and description. You know, Lewis always talks about do your description and your description and your defining, and then save the evaluation, the moral evaluation for later. And I think we have, human beings have a tendency to put the moral evaluation first and then describe people according to our moral evaluation. Now there is a kind of thing where you absorb things, especially if you're not trying to project and you are feeling, you are at this moment where you know that there nothing can harm you. And nothing can harm you. And Christ does not want you to be wiped out or anything like that, and he's with you and so forth. That you can go through days and see all sorts of stuff that you wouldn't see if you were worried. You'd be projecting one thing instead of seeing thousands of things. And I'm amazed like with say you people at this time of the year, you know, in terms of, like, the sessions, you counted the hours of the sessions that we've had. They've not been, you know, that much. But, and in many times I say, well, I just haven't, I've got to do more watching of people, so forth. But when something comes up, I'm just flooded with every time I've seen you this year, you know, that all these little things come up.